Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Thanks for joining me on our weekly In the Loop style tour through the news. You know, to me, this week kind of felt like we took a time machine or something back to the spring of 2002. The economy stinks, we're at war in Afghanistan, everybody's all worked up over Brangelina's new kids, and we had the return of Jesse Ventura, once again telling us he's not running for something. I think that was also the last time anybody cared about Madonna, if I recall. But there was more that caught our eye this week, and we'll get into it in the next 20 minutes. We'll flesh out the possibility of a slow-motion walk, not a run, a walk, on U.S. banks. We're going to think about what Europe tells us about the future of U.S. airlines. And we're going to reflect on why it is so darn hard to make fun of Barack Obama, including a call out to you for your best Obama jokes. Hope you can help us out. First, though, a little more on the serious side. Zimbabwe made it back into the headlines again this week. The president of South Africa has convened a new set of talks trying to work out some kind of a compromise between the ruling party and the opposition there. You might recall the opposition MDC party pulled out of last month's elections. President Robert Mugabe won re-election in a self-reported landslide. And his government, which is not fond of talking about such things, this week released a new official inflation figure for the Zimbabwean dollar. At this moment, prices there are going up 2.2% a year. And that's the official figure, which more than likely understates things. We've been calling Zimbabwe quite a bit this week, trying to raise somebody to talk about conditions there. Between a very unstable phone system and people's fears that the government is listening, it has not been terribly easy. But we have reached Terence Mashinga-Idze. He has been studying in the U.S. for the past year, but he recently returned home. Terence, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. Let me ask you first, where in Zimbabwe are you right now?
I just sit in the country.
The phone is really breaking up. Can I ask you to repeat that?
I'm based in Bulawayo. It's the second largest city in the country.
And how long have you been back in Zimbabwe?
I've been in the country for 2 weeks.
So you're coming back in the midst of the new official figure, 2.2% inflation. And so the main question I have for you is, what in the world is that like?
Well, it's very difficult for people to go by because it means they cannot save money, and also prices of commodities change by the day.
Give me some ideas of what things cost right now.
Okay, let me start with what people are earning. Teachers are earning something like 120 billion. A loaf of bread is going for 50 billion. So that means for a teacher who is earning 120 billion, his salary can only buy 2 loaves of bread.
And that's that salary that you gave me is a is that a weekly salary?
Oh, in Zimbabwe, we are given monthly salaries.
A teacher's monthly salary is enough to afford 2 loaves of bread the way inflation is going right now?
Yes.
My goodness. Just give me a few other prices for things you might buy, say, at the grocery store.
A kilogram of meat is going for 190 billion.
Ah, okay. A kilogram of meat. What else?
Okay, and 750 milliliters of cooking oil is going for 150 billion.
So when things cost so much, how do people shop physically? How do you lay down that kind of money on the counter?
It's difficult. What is happening is that some rentals are now being paid in Forex or in U.S. dollars.
By Forex, you mean foreign exchange?
Foreign exchange, yes.
Yes, okay, they're using other currencies. But that's illegal, I understand, right?
Yes, it's illegal. But what you have to understand is that the local currency, the highest denomination in circulation right now is a $50 billion bill.
And that doesn't get you very far.
Yeah, it doesn't get you very far. And also you have to understand that most goods are no longer available in the shops. So most of the basic requirements, such as mealie meal, cooking oil, and sugar, are found on the black market, where the prices are very, very high.
Do you find that the mood in the country is especially glum right now?
Yeah, it's glum, yeah, because people have a sense of hopelessness. And also, this year is a drought year for Zimbabwe, so there are some food shortages in the country.
There was this German company that used to print all of the actual paper money that the Zimbabwean government was using that has contributed to this inflation. They've stopped doing that for political reasons because of the political pressure. How is the economy going to cope with the loss of those bills?
Sometime last week, there was some panic that there was going to be a shortage of cash. But so far, as of this week, it appears the situation is normal. I'm not so sure about the backup measures that have been taken by the Zimbabwean Central Bank, but it appears money is circulating on the market.
So do you have a sense that some sort of economic collapse is really around the corner? Sounds like the things can hold out for a little while yet.
It appears things will be difficult for people, but the economy, I think, will hold on for quite some time. Of course, right now we are banking on the inter-party talks that are being held between the ruling party and the opposition party, whereby they are trying to come up with some form of political rapprochement.
Are people there in Zimbabwe encouraged by the fact that those talks you mentioned between the ruling party and the opposition are happening, or at least are rumored to be happening?
I think much interest about those talks is confined to people in the political movements. Otherwise, for the ordinary men and women, they are largely concerned with day-to-day struggles for survival.
Over a very difficult phone line from Zimbabwe, Terence Mashingaidze, thank you very much for talking with us for a few minutes.
Okay, thank you very much.
You are listening to The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Let's see what else was in the news this week. Lots of talk about how Beijing has overbuilt for the Olympic Games. It's not so clear who's going to stay in all of these five-star hotels. They did manage, in at least one case, to clear up some great ocean views by cleaning that huge algae bloom that threatened to swamp the sailing events at the Olympics. It's a big week for movie openings. Between Batman and Mamma Mia, looks like couples can plan a great trip to the movies this weekend, as long as they go into separate theaters. The Pope has been in Australia, and he wants you to save the environment. That's his big message at the moment, to which I have one thing to say. Show me the hybrid Pope-mobile. Environmentalism's other high priest, Al Gore, stepped up this week and called for the U.S. to be off fossil fuels completely within 10 years. That's a goal that would cost in the trillions, but he says it is a price worth bearing. President Bush and most Republicans are speaking a totally different language, talking about much more offshore drilling. Maybe we should all look to U.S. Airways, which is doing its part to conserve. Maybe. Pilots say the airline's retaliating against them when they request extra fuel for safety reasons. U.S. Airways says that is not true. Also in airline news this week, Delta and American announced they each lost more than $1 billion in the last quarter. Funny thing is, their share prices actually went up with this news. That's partly because the airlines, especially American, did better than expected at raking in passenger fees. American, you might recall, has started charging to check luggage. And if that's going so well, then what is next? Well, Jay Sorensen is here to help us think about that question. He's an airline industry consultant based in Wisconsin, and he's an expert in so-called ancillary revenue. That's a formal term for all these ways airlines can maybe pry a few extra bucks out of you. Hello, Jay. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your favorite example of the moment, anyway, for the future of our domestic air travel is Ryanair. And now I've heard of Ryanair, but where are they again?
Well, they're all over Europe. They are a low-cost airline. They are the granddaddy of low-cost airlines in Europe. They started out based in Dublin, but now they have airline bases all over the continent as well.
So American Airlines in this most recent quarter followed Ryanair and some other airlines around the world and started charging $15 for your first checked bag, $25 for your second one. The way these things go, other airlines in the U.S. probably aren't very far behind. So what else is Ryanair dinging people for that U.S. airlines aren't doing yet?
Everything under the sun, to a certain degree. You're going to pay a fee to check your bag, to check in at the airport. Everything you want to consume on board the aircraft is going to be purchased. Soft drinks, beer, wine, sandwiches, hot snacks.
But they're not charging you just yet to use the bathroom.
No, they're not. No, they're not.
Do they charge you for the type of seat that you get?
Well, they have a little bit of a different twist on it, and that is they don't have advanced seat assignments like most U.S. carriers do. What they do is you can pay an extra fee to be among the first passengers to board the airplane.
So a number of American airlines are doing various bits and pieces of what Ryanair does. Ryanair throws all of this at the passenger. Don't people just hate to fly Ryanair because you've got to pay for everything?
Well, I guess you can't argue with success. You know, you can get by with a very low fare on Ryanair if you buy at the right time and avoid all the extras. But truth be told, their numbers suggest that people buy into these additional features. So it's a buyer beware market.
So if, as you suggest, airlines in the U.S. Will start adopting more and more of these type of tactics, are tickets actually going to get cheaper because all this stuff we have to pay for as extras?
I think super cheap seats are something that are part of history, a quaint relic of the past. Right now, we're facing a condition which the airlines are hoping that, given hoped for fare increases plus the additions of these fees, that they're able to make a decent return for their investors.
And I suppose you would see that outlook even for Ryanair. They're going to have to raise their prices. Maybe they are already.
At some point, the price of oil will catch up with everyone. And so, yes, we're going to have an environment in which airfares will be higher, there will be more fees, and quite frankly, there will be fewer airlines.
What about an alternate theory here, which would say that some airlines would run in the opposite direction, say, we're full service, we're not going to do that to you?
Well, Austrian Airlines is trying to do that right now, and Austrian Airlines is attempting to pride itself on a far higher standard of service. And so far, the financial results have been quite ruinous for them.
Do you personally like flying, Jay?
I get a thrill if I'm going someplace in business class. If I'm flying a coach, there's a whole lot less thrill associated with it.
The future of air travel, as laid out by aviation consultant Jay Sorensen. His consultancy is called IdeaWorks. Jay, thank you very much for sparing a few minutes for In the Loop.
You're very welcome.
Like all of us, the airlines are trying to get some sense of the road ahead. This week, within hours of one another, two of the most powerful men in the world took to the microphone with their views of the American economy. It was President Bush in a rare White House press conference and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke in his annual report to Congress. And the two guys definitely did not have the same speechwriter. In fact, it's not always clear they're talking about the same economy. Here's a quick recap.
Thank you, Mr. President. Good morning.
Thank you. Every day is a good morning when you get to serve the country.
Chairman Dodds, Senator Shelby, and members of the committee, I'm pleased to present the Federal Reserve's monetary policy report to the Congress.
Bottom line is this. We're going through a tough time. But our economy has continued growing, consumers are spending, businesses are investing, exports continue increasing, and American productivity remains strong.
Economic activity has advanced at a sluggish pace during the first half of this year. The effects of the housing contraction and of the financial headwinds on spending and economic activity have been compounded by rapid increases in the prices of energy and other commodities, which have sapped household purchasing power even as they have boosted inflation.
I think it was in the Rose Garden where I issued this brilliant statement. If I had a magic wand, but the president doesn't have a magic wand, you just can't say, low gas.
Employment in the construction and manufacturing sectors has been particularly hard hit.
Despite the challenges we face, our economy has demonstrated remarkable resilience.
Real earnings have been stagnant so far this year.
Growth is slower than we would have liked, but it was growth nonetheless.
Many financial markets and institutions remain under considerable stress.
We can have confidence in the long-term foundation of our economy.
In part because the outlook for the economy remains uncertain.
And I believe we will come through this challenge stronger than ever before.
Declining values of equities and houses have taken their toll on household balance sheets. Credit conditions have tightened, and indicators of consumer sentiment have fallen sharply.
I'm not an economist, but I do believe that we're growing. And I can remember, you know, this press conference here, people yelling recession this, recession that, as if you're economists. And I'm an optimist. You know, I believe there's a lot of positive things for our economy.
President Bush and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke speaking basically at the same time on Tuesday. Pick who you believe. It's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure economy right now. They've certainly been sensing the downside out in California this week after the federal seizure of IndyMac Bank. There were signs the bank might go under with the weight of bad mortgage investments. Customers lined up around the block to get their money out, even after the feds took over. Now, first of all, what kind of a goofy name for a bank is IndyMac? It's like putting your elderly parents in the skippity-doo-dah nursing home. Something just doesn't sound right. In any case, it was a vivid example of something most of us associate with the Great Depression, a bank run. Most of us have at least a passing familiarity with the concept of a run on the bank. Customers panic about the state of the bank, and everybody wants their money out at the same time. But in the coverage of IndyMac, a less familiar term caught my eye this week, a walk on the bank. I couldn't help but wonder what that would look like and what the risk is. Professor Itai Goldstein from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business is good enough to sit down and indulge my curiosity. Professor Goldstein, thank you very much for joining In the Loop.
Thank you. I'm happy to talk to you.
Runs are fairly easy to spot at this point, easy for federal authorities to isolate like they did in that case. What's this notion of a walk?
There is really nothing fundamentally different in a walk on the bank versus a run on the bank. I would say that a walk on the bank is just a slower, more gradual version of the run on the bank. If you sort of take a step back and think about what bank runs are, people usually like to think about two types of bank runs. There are bank runs that are panic-based, and then there are bank runs that are sort of information or fundamental-based. I would say that a walk on the bank is more likely to be the second type of a bank run than the first type. So, you know, we are talking about sort of more informed institutions, individuals. If they feel that their money should be placed elsewhere, then they just take their money out.
Does the fact that it happens in slow motion make it more dangerous, less dangerous?
I would think overall less dangerous. The fact that it happens in slow motion means that you have more time to collect information, you have more time to react. So the government, the FDIC, could take more time to make decisions on whether the bank should get emergency funds or whatever.
Does that make it more difficult for authorities to know when and where there really is a problem?
Probably, yes. I mean, definitely, you know, when you see a bank run, you know exactly what you see. A walk on the bank is something that is a little bit more subtle and is a little bit more difficult to spot when exactly you should intervene. And we see a lot of this in the press. There is a lot of discussion whether the government should lend money to banks in difficulties or not, because people are not completely sure whether what we see is a bank walk, the beginning of a bank run, or whether what we see is just the normal pace of withdrawals, maybe a little bit amplified by the fact that the economic times are a bit uncertain.
And as the headlines mount, there seem to be some implications that we may be in for something of a gentle walk on the banking system as a whole, as people sort of lose confidence in a broader sense. What kind of risks might that pose?
You know, if something like that happens, obviously the consequences will not be good. There are speculations, but I'm pretty sure that the situation right now is far from that. We have some pretty good institutions in place. There are lessons that were learned from previous crises. And the fact that depositors are insured and the fact that this insurance is in place basically helps to, I think, reassure people before they decide to take their money out of the bank.
Yeah, and as the chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said just this week, as long as her institution has been around, no one has ever lost a penny, even with deposits more than, you know, the guaranteed level of $100,000.
Correct, yes.
Okay, so from where you're sitting, no need to run or even walk terribly quickly toward our banks at this point.
Correct.
Okay, Professor Itai Goldstein from the Wharton School of Business out in Philadelphia, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
I am Jeff Horwich, and you are listening to The Week from In the Loop. Now, we don't need to say a whole lot more about the New Yorker Obama cover, though it was very much in the news this week, but it did underscore one of the great challenges of our time. There is sort of a humorless void right now around Barack Obama. Not that he doesn't have a sense of humor, I'm sure he does, but there's just not very much funny about him. Now, John McCain is easy. He's very old, like 95 or something.
I ask you, what should we be looking for in our next president? I have the courage, the wisdom, the experience, and most importantly, the oldness necessary.
See, even he jokes about it. Our producer, Sandon Totten, has been torturing us around the office trying to come up with Barack Obama jokes this week.
Yeah, it's not an easy task.
All right, so try a few out. What do you got?
Okay, so they're getting a lot better. I'll start off with one of my worst jokes so you can kind of get a sense of how much I've improved.
Very smart.
So the first one, what's Barack Obama's favorite dance?
No idea.
The Yes We Can.
Yep.
Okay. So
it can only get better.
Yeah, it gets a little bit better. I realize, you know, that was my first approach, make fun of, you know, his slogan. I think, you know, a better way to do it might be to harp a little bit more with using some formal joke methods. So this is a light bulb joke. How many Barack Obama supporters does it take to change a light bulb?
I have no idea.
Actually, neither do I. They talk about change, but we haven't seen any yet.
That's not bad.
Politically
sharp.
So that's one approach. But I think another way to go with Barack Obama is to actually make fun of the fact that he's so perfect. So I came up with this one. Why did Barack Obama cross the bridge?
Why?
He was getting tired of walking on water. It made his shoes a little squishy.
Sort of backtracked with that one. I'm a fan of the light bulb joke so far.
Yeah, well, that's the challenge. I mean, Barack Obama is he's kind of hard to poke fun at. But I think people can do it. There's a lot of good joke formulas out there, and there's a lot of funny people. So I'm throwing down the gauntlet. I want someone to do better than me, which shouldn't be hard, and come up with some Barack Obama jokes and send them to us at intheloop@minnesotapublicradio.org. And just tell us your name and where you're from, and we'll put the best of them on the show. I would love to hear a Barack Obama knock-knock joke, by the way. So special props to anybody who can pull that off.
All right, Sandin, thank you very much. One out of three ain't bad.
Thanks, Jeff.
You know, I was thinking about this challenge, and somehow it put a particular tune in my head. It's actually a song about another character who was something of a conundrum, so pure as to be beyond reproach. So as we send you into this weekend, I'll leave you with this. How do you tell a joke about Obama? What can you say that won't make you look bad? Race and faith are both so fraught with drama. Making fun of his ears seems kind of sad. How do you roast a guy who's young and charming? It's out of bounds to mention that he's black. Or half black, I guess, technically. That's just not very funny. He's got no skeletons we've seen. His lifestyle is squeaky clean, except for the fact he likes to smoke a pack. Well, there's just nothing funny about Obama, but eventually he'll slip and we'll attack. The Week is produced by Sandin Totten and me, Jeff Horwich. We are edited by Kate Smith. Our theme music is by The Smarts. The Smarts, in fact, will be joining me on Wednesday as the house band for our latest In the Loop Story Slam. It's at the Bedlam Theater in Minneapolis, and we would love for you to be there, either to hop on stage with a story or just enjoy the evening. Our theme this time, inspired by current events, Tightening the Belt. But of course, you can take that theme and bend it any which way you like. Get tickets online at our website, minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop, or at the door, just $10, and you get $5 back if you sign up to tell a story. Hope to see you there Wednesday night, and on your radio or podcast device again next Friday when we return with The Week from In the Loop.